This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Okay, before we have internet streaming problems, okay, and I roll over in bed this morning at about 5-something. I get an email, and I always wake up for that stuff for whatever reason. Hey, man, I hate to do this to you, but I'm out. I got a family emergency. Joining me is the man who wrote that, who made an incredible comeback, Alex Hollings. So how's your Monday going?
It's, you know... First and foremost, I didn't even realize it was Monday until you said it right now. I knew I was going on the air today, but I haven't had a chance to process days of the week yet today. It's been stressful, but you know, I'm still here. I made it to a phone, so things can't be that bad, right? How about you, man? What's going on with you?
Well, actually, you canceling wasn't that bad because I had recorded a really cool interview last week with a country music artist by the name of Peyton Davis, who's the friend of a guy who comes on the program on a regular basis, a buddy of mine, an F-18 guy. And Peyton she's a former junior ROTC person, father committed suicide. She's now a country music singer, and she's trying to go on a USO tour. So I recorded a really cool interview with her. And I wasn't in the bind that I normally would be. So, and then we go on the air, and I start getting emails. Hey, man, your audio is playing fast and then skipping.
Oh, no.
Yes. Like, I've heard, like, a lot of times because of streaming, you know, your music will, you know, audio will cut out and things like that. But so skipping.
But playing fast is an unusual.
Yes.
And skipping. We're not using CDs anymore. I remember the days of anti-skip CD players. You know?
I'll even do you one better. I remember the days of LPs when they used to skip. Okay?
Yeah, you've got me there. I mean, I've certainly seen LPs. But,
yeah.
You know,
well, let me tell you.
I'm a cassette tape guy. I'm of the cassette tape generation.
You're a boo. Yeah. The, with records, a few things you had to take care of. One, you could not leave them in the sun, right? If you, like, for instance, if you left them on a chair or something, and that evening, and then you ran out and you played basketball, and then the sun comes up and the sun beats on the on that LP for most of the day, it will never play again because it's going to have a wave in it. I mean, literally, the vinyl.
You know, and these are the types of challenges. I actually was talking to my wife about this just the other day about our daughter. And the things that we see as intrinsic parts of daily life, you know, these things that you don't even think twice about, it's just something you deal with every day, are problems that may never even surface for her. You know, like, concerns that we regularly have about internet connectivity out here in the woods of Georgia,
right,
may very well be a thing of the past by the time she's an adult.
Yes, her brain's brain's going to be telekinetically linked to other brains around the world.
You know, it probably will be. This little girl, I mean, she's 9 months old, or she will be here in 2 days. 9 months old.
Oh.
And she already, if she can get her hands on one of our phones,
Jeez. We'll
grab it and start swiping. You know, I worry, though.
Wait,
you know,
careful with the swipe. You're not on, like, Tinder or anything like that, are you? That'll get you in trouble.
No, just start swiping around on the screen, what I mean? Opening apps, deleting apps, things like that, you know? And I worry sometimes because I'm like, should I be trying to keep her away from technology like this until she's older and has a better way to grasp it? But then on the other hand, I wonder, this is the world that she's going to grow up into, is this digitally connected world. Would I be doing her a hindrance by keeping her from these things?
And I
don't know the answer. So I go back and forth. Get away from the screen.
I think there's a happy medium. First of all, it's a moderately interesting toy, as toys go.
Yeah, agreed.
right? A lot of, you know, a lot of bells and whistles, very amusing. Okay.
Well, you know, and for her too, because I, you know, Lord knows I work 7 days a week and more hours in the day than I would care to admit. So I'm always attached to my phone. And I'm sure she reads that already, you know, and is like, this is what grown-ups do. This thing that dad's always playing with. I definitely want in on that.
I need to know. I need to be involved. I need to be involved in this. But there's the there's this conundrum. All right. If I go the homeschool route and turn my kid into a dork, or if I cave in and go the permissive parent route and I turn my kid into an idiot. So
this is a real conversation we've been having lately, this homeschool versus public school versus private school debate.
Well, there's a social element there. You don't want your kid to be a dork.
There really is.
But you want your kid to be a hard-working, smart person, and I think that involves a little bit of parental I don't know how to say this, frankness. I think you have to tell them the truth. And when they suck, you have to look at them and say, hey, bro, you suck. Do you want to know why you suck in Little League? Because you never practice. So you have to be okay with sucking, okay, and the other kids being good, and you're not playing as much as them because you don't care about it. And, you know, so you're just here for the snacks, bro. You know? Right? And you got to be able to, you got to be willing to tell them that. Or else they turn into idiots.
Before I had a kid, I was aimed. My wife wanted us to, you know, one day when we had children, wanted them to go to private school. You know, I'm a public school guy. I got my bachelor's and my master's both from state colleges. You know what I mean? I've never had the money, let alone the initiative, I suppose. I never really wanted to go to a private school. But, you know, I can hear where she's coming from, where she says, you know, you have a better chance of getting a good education than in some public schools in the South, you know, and so forth. However, I feel like the important part of school is the social element, you know? And I don't know what the social element is in a private school. It could be spectacular. But I do know what it is at public schools, and I think that is in large part responsible for who I am. The way I was shaped by, I moved around a lot, so I went to a lot of public schools. But I was shaped by that, you know? However, now that I have a daughter, I'm like, maybe I should just keep her locked in my basement, and I'll teach her what she needs to know and make sure nobody talks to her or touches her. Make sure there's no public school shootings, none of that stuff. I realize that that's not necessarily the healthy approach, but there is a, what is there, you know, in me where I go, if I keep her here, I can keep her safe. And I don't just mean from physical violence, but I don't need those boys talking to her and breaking my little girl's heart. I don't need other girls being jerks to her. I can keep her here, we'll watch Paw Patrol, and everything will be fine.
Paw Patrol. I watched Paw Patrol for the first time 2 weeks ago with my grandson.
I gotta tell you, man, it grows on you. I don't watch it yet with
lame.
My daughter, but my
it's,
nephew
it's
loves
so
it.
It's so lame. Nobody gets this.
Oh, man.
Nobody gets the shit beat out of
him.
Come
trust
on,
me.
Man.
It's all bad.
Oh, my God.
You gotta pick the best bad one.
Yeah, but get him on Bugs Bunny. You know, somebody's gonna get blasted. Somebody's gonna get beat up. I mean, those are like.
Dave and Ava. My daughter does love Dave and Ava. And, man, it gets on your nerves.
Tom and Jerry. Come on. Those are awesome cartoons. Now it's like everybody's nice, everybody's inclusive. You know, all that messaging in that content for your kids. I'm a Catholic school kid from like K through 12 and then 3 years in college. Went 2 years to community college in California, got my general education stuff done. And then went to the University of San Diego, which is a Catholic university. So
now, would you say that going to Catholic school shaped you in a way that you think might be different than having gone?
Well,
to public school?
I will tell you this. One of the things that I did enjoy about Catholic school as I got older, I mean, when I was little, it was just where I went to school. I didn't know any different. I mean, I used to look across the fence at the school was called Mac School, and it wasn't named after me. I was still too young at that point. I had done a whole lot to have a school named after me, and it was spelled M-A-C-K.
Preemptive.
It was spelled M-A-C-K, not M-A-C. So again, it wasn't named after me. I think it was named after the big landowner who donated all the land to the school district. But anyway, that's just where I went to school. It's where my friends were. It's where, you know, and I didn't know any better. It was very, the neighborhood I grew up in was you know, middle class neighborhood in Sacramento, California. My dad was in a minor league baseball guy. And so, all the parents
That's
were
awesome. Yeah, That's really cool.
Yeah, they were just the working class parents, tended to be Catholic, sending their kids to Catholic school. And we got raised rough. I mean, the nuns, they didn't take shit off you. When you acted like a punk, they treated you like a punk. And so I thought that was good for me in particular because it scared me. And then, but there was always an expectation that I would treat people a certain way and that I would achieve academically and achieve, and not just show up, but achieve. And I think Catholic schools pushed that. And so I thought that was good for me. But I also thought that there was an element of spirituality there that was present every day that I went to school. And that was, how are you going to treat people? Why would you do that? Why would you treat somebody else like that? And I thought that was good for me, too, in terms of my development. So private school, just private school, no, never. You know what you're going to find there? Everybody who's got the latest iPhone. Is that what you want for Trixie? No.
Well, you know, and that's especially a concern when it comes to social competition.
Oh.
You know, parents isn't necessarily the first thing you think of, but I remember, as I said, I moved around a lot. I was also very poor, right? When I was
how
a
poor?
Kid.
Give us an example of how poor.
When I was born, we lived in a 19-foot camping trailer that had no water and got power from an extension cord. Poor. Very poor. Right? We were progressively better off.
How many in the family?
I was the second child at that point.
In the night?
No, we moved.
Camper?
In a camper. No, so I don't have active memories of the camper. I remember we moved from there to an attic that had plastic stapled to the walls. And we all stayed in the attic for a while, and then we moved. My dad was in college when I was born. He got his GED later in life and got his bachelor's even later in life. And so by the time my dad graduated, I was a few years old, and we started kind of moving up the housing echelons to the point where by the time I was in high school, we were doing pretty well for ourselves. You know, in Vermont, we were an upper-middle-class family. You know, but we moved around a lot in the meantime because it was where can you find work, where can you get some money, you know?
Right.
And so being the perpetual new kid and being the poorest kid in school was a very difficult position to be in growing up. But it armed me with skills like talking, you know, and I'm not saying that I necessarily wouldn't have been a talker.
Yeah, I'm struggling with you learning how to needing to learn how to talk because you seem like the Roy Hobbs of talking. You seem like the natural.
Well, you know, I was born by fire, right? From the time that I was in, I think I split my kindergarten year between two schools and then had a different school every year after that until like eighth grade, you know? So these are the kinds of things that, depending on the situation, I can recall these memories as, like, a really tough story, you know, from my childhood. But I don't see it that way. You know, I grew up in a rough household as well, you know, and my dad made plenty of mistakes. But all these things shaped me into this pretty well-rounded guy that I am now that, well, I might, you know, I've got this unique...
Okay, let's talk about that. So what do you attribute that to? Because you have all kinds of shit in your little laundry bag that you could play the woe is me card on any one of them. We moved too much. I was born into a camper. I lived in a place that had plastic stapled to the wall. My dad made plenty of mistakes. Which one of those do we want to turn into the woe is me victim card? So why didn't you become the woe is me victim?
Well, I think part of it was where I come from. You know, my dad grew up wealthy, right? And, managed to not be wealthy, but the time, you know, the kids got there. But my dad never played the woe is me card either. I mean, maybe he did behind closed doors, you know, with his friends. I couldn't tell yet, but his approach to life was always, it's gonna get better. You know, it can get better. And I think a big part of that, I think, the fact that my family had that approach to life, which was, I realize we've only lived here for 8 months, but we're going to move to another town in another state because it'll be better. The next thing is always an opportunity for things to be better, right? And I think that played a really big role in me. To be honest, some of it played a role in the opposite way. Like, my older brother and I talk about this a lot. He's got a 3-year-old son. I've got a 9-month-old daughter. We'll catch ourselves doing things that remind us a little too much of our dad when we were young.
Right.
You know, and
which is, natural, right? Natural.
Yeah, you know. And I think that some of those lessons, and I don't mean to, my father passed away recently. I don't mean to speak ill of him, but he made plenty of mistakes when we were kids. And I think that was an important lesson for me, too, because I was always aware. I was cognizant right from a very young age. Maybe it was my mom or my brother that taught it to me. But when my dad would come in and beat the crap out of us, we knew that it wasn't the right thing to do. You know?
Well, it might be the right thing to do. What were you doing? What was he going to do? Come in and talk to you? Oh, boy. Playing with matches. For instance, when I turned on the natural gas and lit it, and they weren't around, and then I heard the car pull up, and I tried to shut it off, but it didn't. I didn't turn the key all the way, and the flame was still going. And so I went and got water, and I poured water on the gas pipe right in the fireplace, and got it to the flame to go out, and then ran and put the whatever I used back in the kitchen. And then I'm standing there, and they come walking in. Hey, what's going on? Nothing. What's that smell of gas? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, you might have deserved a good slap.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
There's a difference between. There's a difference when it comes to discipline. Like, my mom was the lady who would come in and spank you, or even slap you on the cheek, like slap you in the mouth if you were talking back. My dad's method was more, guy, I'm fighting behind a bar.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah, that's different. That's different.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a rough house to grow up in, you know, and it was kind of equal for all of us, you know, but as bad as those times were, and, you know, and some of the fallout from it, you know, my dad got arrested for it and whatnot.
Oh,
shit. As bad as even those times were, they imparted really important lessons in me.
Like?
You know, to the point where now, you know, my wife and I have been together for, you know, 13, 14 years, but we just recently had our first kid. But, you know, my wife is a fighter, man. You know, when she gets upset, she swings, you know. And years ago, I told her the rule in our house is that nobody ever hits each other.
Can you take her?
You know, I grew. Say again.
Can you take her? Like, could she like kick your ass?
Oh, could I take? I mean, I've got her by size and weight. She's all kind of like this fire inside her. I think that I would hesitate out of love, and she would just murder me. But you know, so even if you know, because her, you know, she's 5'4", 110 pounds. She doesn't think she could hurt me.
Right.
You know, or, you know, at 6'2", 250. But, you know, she certainly can. You know, those little knuckles can still hurt. But it's not
If you're not looking, man, if you're not looking, that's when bad stuff happens.
But it's not about whether or not it actually hurts physically. It's about the intent behind it, right? Like, we need to manage our emotions in a better way than that.
Whoa.
And honestly, I think...
You sound like, what are you? Like, and you become Ann Landers? How did you get this mature, for the love of God? What the hell?
Well, I tell you what, man, you get pretty mature when you're trying to keep your head attached, you know, as you grow up. However, you know, right. I definitely have a little bit of that. I've got the fight in me, which is why I've always pursued, you know, I don't call it... Dancing is a contact sport. I played football and rugby, which are collision and impact sports, you know?
Right, right.
I was a fighter through high school, through college, and then in the Marine Corps I was a fighter. I still have it in me. But I would argue that because of my childhood, I've learned to manage those emotions, or at the very least to engage with them when they crop up. When I feel myself being like, I'm so angry right now that I'm not making rational decisions, I'll pull myself out of the situation. But I might not have that insight had I not grown up worried about dad. You know what I mean? In the Marine Corps, it really, really benefited me. Because in a leadership position, especially among Marines, there are times, and there were times, where I was like, I tell you what, man, let's put our McNair belts up on it. If you can beat me, you can have my black belt. But it was always a controlled situation because I knew animosity doesn't solve things. Anger doesn't solve things. You know, violence occasionally, God's honest truth, can solve problems.
Thank you.
You know, especially between brothers, friends, or Marines.
Thank you.
But it's the approach to the violence, it's the way in which you use it. It's one thing to demonstrate that I'm superior to you as a fighter. It's another thing to try to hurt you. And those should be separate. It's the reason why when you're sparring with somebody, you know that guy who doesn't know how to not go 100%? Yeah. You know, so, okay, we're doing half speed, 50% sparring drills, and he just comes in swinging for the fences.
Yeah.
That guy might well hurt you.
He's an idiot.
He's an idiot.
So how do you do that control? How do you deal with that guy? You punch it 100% too. And that way it's the only way he learns.
You know, you might not even have to punch it 100%, depending on where he is and where you're at.
No, you need to. That's my point. You need to. He's taking advantage. Everybody's pulling their punches, right? 60%. All of a sudden, boom. I did that to a kid at the infantry officer course. His last name is Miller. He used to smoke this Italian kid. I can't remember his name. Give me a second and I will. He used to smoke him with the same move every day. And you're sitting with your friends in this circle. Guys are fighting in the center. And his name's Vince Scalzo. Guy's name is Miller. And Miller would shuffle his feet, right? He'd be in like the on guard position and he'd shuffle his feet. So he'd kind of, without moving his upper torso, he'd bring his back foot forward, right? And so when he'd throw a punch, his reach was really long because he had shuffled his feet. It wasn't just a normal punch that you could kind of lean back from. So Scalzo would lean back, and this thing would smoke him, and he didn't pull the punch. And so my friend started to sit there and said, you know what, if you just take the preemptive back quicker, he's going to go right by you, and his jaw is just going to be sitting there. So one day, McNamara and McMahon, my roommate from New Jersey, Scalzo and Miller. Boom, McMahon and Scalzo eliminated each other, and then it's me and Miller. Thunderdome.
I got to ask you, man, what was Scalzo's MOS?
He's a grunt. We're just an infantry officer course in Quantico, man.
I knew an older Scalzo who was a chief warrant officer that, and he was a person. No. And I felt as though that was very in keeping with his personality. So I just out of curiosity.
And Scalzo was a nice guy, but he used to get smoked. So now I had on the helmet, I think. And so you fought in pairs. One guy had a pugil stick and a helmet. And the other guy, one guy had on the kickboxing head gear and a pugil stick. The other guy had the football helmet on and the kung fu gloves. So I have the football helmet on and the kung fu gloves. Scalzo has, that's what he used to do with it, with the pugil stick. He'd shuffle his feet and then he'd throw this horizontal butt stroke and he would knock Scalzo's out. He would knock him out. Boom. And that's when he said, if you just lean back good, right, he'll whiff on that horizontal butt stroke. And then what's going to be sitting there is his fucking mug. And then just hit him as hard as you can. So that's ultimately what happens. I wind up with the kickboxing stuff and the football helmet. And here's Miller, and he tries that same move on me. I lean back. Whoosh, there goes the horizontal butt stroke. Now, McNamara, decision point. Do you really punch him as hard as you can, or do you pull the punch like you're supposed to? What do you think I did?
Well, based on the story, I'm going to assume you punched him as hard as you could.
I hit him as hard as I could. I hit him as hard as I could, knocked him back, hit him a second time as hard as I could, and then pile drove him to the ground. How pissed do you think Miller was, Mr. Kung Fu himself? Miller said that when he used to have sex, when he would have an orgasm, he used to yell Marine Corps. This is the kind of idiot he was, okay? Right? So I thought I was doing humanity. I was like, I'm like Michael the Archangel. I'm on the side of right. So my friends are screaming and yelling. And then this IOC instructor like tackles me because I'm on top of him. And he like throws me. And then he's on top of me. And he looks down at me and goes, that was awesome. He goes, you guys are going to fight again. And so I'm like, what? And he's like, let's go. So The same thing happens, and the exact same thing happens. He tried that same move again, and I
busted. Because it's a one-trick pony.
Yeah, and I busted him in the mouth a second time. He ripped his gear off. He throws it on the ground. His lips bleeding, and he yells, "You're supposed to pull your punches." And my friends start yelling at him, "You've been doing that to Scazzo all year, you asshole. You got what you deserve." So I'm just saying, violence.
I can tell a story kind of on the opposite end of this. In terms of the need to develop humility, right? When I first joined the Marine Corps' first mixed martial arts team that it ever had was Fight Club 29 out in 29 Palms. Sergeant Major Mark Galecko, now retired, was not only the coach of that fight team, but he was also the defensive coordinator for the West Coast Championship football team that I played on. So that year, you know, I had just gotten my brown belt in McMap. I was playing defensive end. We had just won our second, Marine Corps West Coast Championship, which theoretically is supposed to be what puts you in the game for the all-Marine team. But during the years that I played, they had, like, because of funding issues, they never had the all-Marine team. They just said, you're all-Marine. the season ended. I'm in great shape because, you know, I just got done playing a dominant season, playing defensive end. And I went to Sergeant Major Coleco, who was our battalion sergeant major, and was like, "Hey, coach, you know, I'm in good shape. Now I've got nothing left to play. I would really love to get in there with Fight Club 29. But up until that point, it was all really sound fighters. It was guys who brought fighting with them to the Marine Corps. You know what I mean? Like, this guy was a black belt in something, enlisted into the Corps, and now does that as well. So I would be, for all intents and purposes, probably the only guy that was only a McMap-trained fighter, other than whatever nonsense I did, you know, in high school with my friends, scholastic wrestling and things
right,
like that.
Right, right.
You know, so when I got in there, I'll be honest, I came in thinking pretty highly of myself. I'm the toughest dude in my group of friends, right? Whenever my unit would do McMap training, I dominated. So in my mind, I must be a dominant fighter. There's a very important line between someone who does this because it's fun and someone who does this. And those guys were dudes who did this. You know, they were fighters. Right. So when I came in thinking pretty highly of myself. And I was a pretty big dude. You know, at the time I was probably walking around at 225, you know, with very low body fat because I was on active duty. And I was a pretty big guy. So when I got there, they were like, "Well, you're going to spar with our heavyweight guy, a guy named Nate." I think his last name was Granville. He's like, "This guy, Ivan Drago. He was a monster." And, you know, so they're like, "Well, you're going to spar with Nate. We're doing full contact sparring today because he's got a fight in 2 weeks, and he's got to be prepared for it. So you're wearing full gear. You're going to get in there and really swing." I was probably in the ring for 30 seconds before he pumped kicked me in the stomach hard enough that shit literally started to come out.
Ah!
I had to jump out of the ring. I had to run to the port-a-john because we worked out in a hangar out in the middle of the desert in 29 Palms. I had to run to the port-a-john and get there, like, with my cheeks clenched together. And, man, as I went, you could hear everybody in that gym laughing. There were probably 15 guys on the team, plus trainers on, you know, loving it, loving every bit of it. And as I sat there on that toilet, I was like, "Well, I can't come out of this port-a-john.
Ever.
Where I live now. I'm just going to stay here till after dark. Once they've all gone home, I will, I'll go back to my house and just never leave again, and I will not tell my wife of this." You know, but, you know, so eventually, you know, I gathered up what little pride I had left and came back out of the port-a-john, waiting to get made fun of mercilessly by all these guys. And instead, everybody there had this kind of shared understanding that the stuff that we do here is funny.
Hey, can I tell you something? And I think everybody experiences this. You know, I didn't grow up doing a lot of fighting. I think I'd gotten one fight as a kid. You know, one legitimate fight as a kid, and then, you know, some bar bullshit, parking lot bullshit at 2:05 in the morning in college and things like that. But I didn't know if I was a good fighter or not. And the thing that I discovered about learning to fight in the Marine Corps, you know, at IOC, and things like that was that I was actually a pretty good fighter. I didn't know that, so it was kind of an epiphany for me. But my observation was, it didn't matter if you won or lost, as long as you fought. Guys have respect for that. You're gonna get your balls busted, and people are gonna laugh. But everybody respects if you'll fight, even if you go in there. I mean, you look at guys who aren't great fighters, but they go in there and they get it on. Everybody has respect for them. It's a Absolutely. Pretty, you know, and fighting's a pretty cool little event.
That was the mentality that I maintained throughout learning to fight, training for it, and as I was on my way to my first tournament, which, so like I had to cut down to 185 from 225 to make weight, so I was already just in a bad place. You know, so I weighed in the day prior to the fight. I probably gained 15 pounds overnight. We're on our way, it's a civilian tournament, so we're an all-Marine team going to compete against civilian fighters. And it's like a two-hour drive. I think it was like Irvine, California or something. And the whole way out there, I was like getting myself mentally prepared to go and win this fight. And, my, you know, my wife was coming. My entire shop was coming to go watch, you know, because I was a corporal at the time. But I was the platoon sergeant. They were all coming to go watch their platoon sergeant fight. And it had never crossed my mind once that I might lose until my wife was like, oh, man, it'll be really embarrassing if you lose, though, you know? And I was like, you bitch.
How could you put that in my head?
Because it never crossed my mind. I was like, well, I'm obviously going to win.
Obviously.
So, you know, I just got to make sure I'm in the right state of mind to do that. And then she was like, man, won't it just be embarrassing if all of the guys see you lose? And I was like, well, what? Sure as hell will be. Yeah, it'll be really embarrassing. Thanks. You know, but so then I got into it. You know, I did end up winning. Oh, but man, it was close, and this guy was a schlubby piece of shit.
Was he?
You know, I stepped into the ring. He had an Under Armour shirt on because he was self-conscious about his fat ass. And he had black nail polish on all of his fingernails.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, this guy's done. This guy's done. You know? And I went from 225 to 185 in the span of like a month and a half. So I was really a much bigger guy than I should have been in that fight anyway. And I went after him sloppy. And learned a hard lesson for it. You know, he looked like a slub. So I went in sloppy. I went for a double leg takedown, found myself in an embarrassing chokehold that damn near choked me out standing up. You know, he's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy. Fortunately for me, I got my chin tucked enough. Eventually I worked it out and I just started slamming him on the mat. And I ended up winning the decision as time ran out. But I came very close to losing that first fight to this pudgy dude with nail polish on in front of my wife, my shop. You know, it was
humbling. Humbling.
Seeing that fight was embarrassing, let alone if I had lost it. You know, the way that I won that fight was embarrassing. But it really is true. When I left, you know, I went home with like my little medal that I got for winning my fight and having won my first fight, which was the most important takeaway from that day. You know, it's one thing to win a scrap, you know, it's one other thing. Because a fight you get into in an alley is a completely different beast. It's like comparing checkers to a sword fight. You know, they're different settings with different rules. But winning my first fight took a lot of that pressure off. You know, took a lot of the scare out of me. But man, oh man, it didn't occur to me that it would be embarrassing to lose until right before my first fight. And that totally took me off my game. and actually, to be honest with you, most of my fighting career ended up going that way. I'm a slow starter. The first round almost always goes to the other guy. You know, I always tell myself it's because I'm figuring him out. But, you know, maybe I'm like the New England Patriots for a long time. It's just like, yeah, they didn't show up for the second half, and then they played just good enough to win.
Let's not go there. Now, relate this back to, you know, like, so you grew up in that environment, and then will it affect you? I'll tell you a quick story.
Oh man, I'll tell you what, growing up in that environment made me a better fighter.
No. I'm talking about with your dad and all that, and then how this relates to you as a parent, as a disciplinarian. We're sitting, and there must be a dozen captains, maybe more, waiting for a company of lieutenants to come out. We're gonna do like squad in the O, we're gonna do squad attacks all day, right? Something like that. So there's a bunch of us. We're sitting there, and in the story had been this horrific story of child abuse, and then we're standing around talking about it. We're sitting. Everybody got a knife, right? So if you can imagine this, we're in Quantico. We're in some kind of mess area waiting for the lieutenants to arrive. So we're sitting on this huge tree that's fallen over. Guys sitting, guys standing, and we're having this bullshit session about this story. And it was about a parent that had beaten a child. And we got into this discussion about spanking. And somebody said, guy sitting next to me, he's got a guy named Jeff Weiss. His nickname is Snuffy. I don't know why, but somebody said, yeah, but if you children who get beaten it's statistically proven that they are more than likely going to beat their own kids. And Jeff Weiss didn't say a whole lot, and he said, I think that's bullshit, right? And everybody stopped. It's like when the Indian guy talks and one flew over the cuckoo's nest. What did he just say? He just spoke. So we looked and said, why'd you say that? And he said, well, my dad beat the shit out of us. He said, I knew what was wrong when he was doing it, and I don't know that I could ever do that to my kid. You know, in fact, I know I couldn't do that to my kid. So how did the way you grew up and your own father's physicality, how will that define you as a parent?
Well, I think in a certain way it will, you know. However, I hope that's in a beneficial way. You know, because the biggest lesson that I learned growing up in a house like that is that pain's not really that big a deal. You know, I think that that's the type of lesson that a lot of Marines learn as adults after they join the service. Right. Some of them may take that lesson with them, but, you know, a lot of the guys that I served with wanted to avoid discomfort and pain the best they could. You know, that's a normal human instinct to do. I know you know probably better than many that feeling you get where you're so tired and you're so hurt that you can't do anything but laugh about it.
Right. Right. And say something like, I wish everybody I knew was here with me right now.
Yeah, you know. But it's hard to develop that mentality without being faced with no alternative, right? And the benefit that I had coming up in an environment where, number one, seeing people that you love get hurt, you know, seeing your mom get hurt, makes you think you don't want to do that, right? But number two, getting hurt yourself is only a big deal for so long, you know? There comes a real point where you're not that worried about getting punched in the face. You know what I mean? And once you have that power where you're like, I'm not that worried about getting punched in the face, it's hard to hold something over your head anymore. And that's the reason why I genuinely believe when it comes to things like discipline, you're better off instilling discipline using something other than violence or pain, because pain has got a diminishing return. Aside from the emotional, moral,
yeah, but we both know if you're using pain to instill discipline, you've lost.
Exactly.
You've lost. And I will tell you this.
Every time you use it, it works a little less.
Well, yeah.
You know?
I the best parenting advice I ever got was from my late father-in-law. He had 8 kids. And he said, and he looked at me and he said, if they don't understand what no means before they reach the age of 2, you're in for it. When you say no, they should stop and they should go do something else. And then he says this, and when they're under the age of 2, it's easy, right? By the sound of your voice and the way you grab them, right? And the look on your face, you can flick their diaper with your finger, and you're going to get this. Right?
Absolutely.
So, or when they're messing with electrical outlets and things like that, and you slap their hand, it should hurt them. It should cause them distress. Now, that's not child abuse. Okay? You're not leaving a bruise or anything like that. But when they're little,
it's negative.
Exactly.
Stimulus. It's just like burning your hand on the stove, you know?
Right. And so,
but when it comes to doing something like really hitting your kids.
Let me finish my point. What my point is, I've raised 4 of them. And Mike's wife and I are on the same sheet of music as parents. All right. And that is, when we say no, no means fucking no. Right,
yeah.
And let me tell you, it's amazing to me to watch in any environment I visit, and I was just in Quantico a couple weeks ago, hanging out with my own kid, and then seeing them interact with their neighbors on the block because they all live together, right? And the number of people that say no and their kids don't even slow down.
Yes.
It's ridiculous. And my point is this, you don't have to hit them that much to get it. You have to be consistent, and you have to.
Yes.
It has to start from day 0. And if you'll do
in that way, it's not different than beating Marines.
No, it's the same, but it's consistency. And when you're laying on the couch and you say, "Don't touch that," and they look at you, and then they go ahead and touch it, if you don't get off the couch, then guess what? You're going to reap what you sow because they know you don't mean shit that you say. But I will tell you this. If you consistently get off the couch, you won't have to discipline your kid that much in your kid's life because guess what they know? They know with certainty you will come get them. And so the next time when you say don't touch it and they look at you and you raise your eyebrows, they go to the box of toys and they go get something else out. No means no. And so parenting advice.
Now, so the inverse of that, if you go too far, right, because I agree with you there. So when you grow up in a house like mine, I distinctly recall the day in which my dad and I both realized at the same time that he wasn't going to be able to hurt me anymore.
Oh, man.
You know, I was like 13 or 14 years old, and we lived in Connecticut at the time. And, you know, I was pinned up against the door, and he, you know, pulled back and he swung and he hit me, and didn't hurt that bad. And I went from like that crouched cowering position to kind of a standing upright and looking him in the eye position.
Uh-oh.
And he went one more time, and I didn't really faze me much, and he and I both just kind of like went, well, I guess that's the end of that, and he walked away. And the nature of our relationship changed very deeply that day. You know, I don't think we talked to each other much for a couple of years after that. You know, and like, so the problem with using pain, whether it's in the Marine Corps, at home, wherever, if you're a coach on a little league team or a college team, the problem with using pain as discipline is that the moment the pain is no longer a threat, either because they've just toughened up enough, they got bigger, or maybe you aren't able to exert enough pain anymore to make it scary, you have no power or authority left. Because you never garnered any respect. You just garnered fear. And fear will only motivate you to do so much.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And the same can be said, in all honesty, for non-physical violence. For things like emotional violence in the workplace. If you're that guy, if you're the guy who's always yelling and screaming, eventually people stop listening. Right?
Right.
But just like you said, with your buddy who, you know, when he spoke up, everybody listened. You
right.
know? On my high school football team, I was co-captains with a guy named Matt Perry, and I never shut up. I was hooting and hollering and yelling and screaming at everybody all the time. You better believe when Perry spoke before games, crickets.
Right.
Everyone was listening to what Perry had to say. You know, whereas for me, I'd have to, you know, get in your face and yell and scream at you because I'm always yelling and screaming. You know, the rule of diminishing returns, whenever you're using negativity in some way to try to enforce a policy, a regulation, decision, whatever it may be, you've got to stay cognizant of the fact that it's only going to work for so long. You need to give them a reason to listen to you outside of that fear. You know, and I think that as a parent growing up in that environment where things were very fear-based, it showed me how little that works. You know, I didn't do what my parents told me to do. I was a good kid, you know, good enough.
Let me tell you what I've seen in my life. Timeout corner, failure. Right? Failure. You're going to make decisions, and so you don't eat your carrots. You're not going to get dessert. they throw a fit at dinner. They act like assholes. And then when it comes time to deprive them of dessert, they do the same thing, and ultimately they don't get the dessert everybody else is having, but they'll get something else, maybe a popsicle, maybe something else. So to me, how you create good people, good little kids, I know the way that I've done it, and we're 4 for 4 in terms of respectful, good kids who, when you said no, they stopped because they knew.
Yeah, I just met, you know, I can attest to this. I met Mike Sud recently online. Awesome, awesome guy. Like, very polite, you know, very articulate. You know, it was a pleasure talking to him. You know, so there's clearly something to your method.
Well, and again, I could probably count with each one of them how many times I laid my hands on them after the age of 2. And it was normally because they lit something on fire or they went around the corner. This is no shitter. They went around the corner in a residential neighborhood on 2 wheels, right? And so he needed to have a spiritual experience. And so he got one, right?
You know, and I'm a big believer as well when it comes to that.
But again, not punching your kid.
Yeah, no.
To grab him by the shirt and say, hey, listen to me. look into my eyes. Do you see any bit of humor or joking around? If you think there is, then you're mistaking anger for that, right? You take everything we own when you get in that car. It's not a joke. If a little kid runs out from between two cars and you kill him, we'll get sued and we'll lose every little thing we have. And we don't have much, okay? And so to me, there's appropriate times that you need to get in their face. Okay, but what you're describing,
my mom's a good example of that.
But what you're describing as a kid,
you're gonna get slapped in the mouth. Yeah. You know, it's as simple as that. If you swear at my mother, she's gonna hit you. You know, it's gonna happen. In my opinion, that's not child abuse. In my opinion, you know, I mean, the Lord knows, I'm sure people might disagree with me.
Who swears at their mother?
Right, exactly. I tell you what, I did it once. I was probably 16, 17 years old, and I called my mom a bitch. She slapped me right in the mouth, and we both looked at each other as soon as she did it. Like, I think I was already a pretty big dude, you know, at 16, 17, and my mom's not. But I think I probably looked at her like the way a deer looks at a hunter. You know, like, for my mom to do that, you're in trouble. You did something, you know? Yeah. You need to take a step back and think about what... She didn't say, don't do that. She didn't, you know what I mean? Like, as soon as she crossed that barrier between the two of us, it was like, whatever you just did was at a high enough level that mom's breaking mom's rules. You know?
Right.
You need to take a step back and think about what it is that you've done. However, you know, but some credit is due to your kids, right? I do think that some kids are just assholes, you know? I mean, we all grew up with one.
Right.
That one kid that you're like, that guy's going to be a serial killer, you know?
No, and you can see him in a family, right? And the family, everybody gets raised the same, and there's one idiot. I agree with you. Part of it is the kid. But I will tell you this. I think as a parent, and it can't just be, you know, consistent discipline, you know, to me, as a parent, again, not everybody can do this. One, hopefully you want to be a parent and you like parenting. You know, somebody asked me within the last couple months, you know, Max, so you don't golf and you don't do this? I said, no, I used to work and go home and, you know, I hung out with my family. There's to me nothing more fun than hanging out with my, you know, my family. And that's what I enjoy.
You know, I agree there, man.
And so,
I live out in the middle of the woods.
Well, to see and you know, to watch them, it's a lot like mentoring, right, in the Marine Corps. To see the light go on, it's a lot like coaching in athletics. To see the light go on and to see them begin to conquer the demons, whether it be, you know, mathematics or how to throw a curveball or getting cut from a team or the girl that you like doesn't like you. When you watch them navigate all those things in life, and you're there to give them advice and constantly kind of reinforce the keys of life, how to overcome failure, how to be a good person, how to care about other people, things to be involved. And, you know, you don't think they're paying attention, but guess what? They are paying attention. But to me, and this is the other side of discipline, you should be a fun parent. You should be somebody that they want to spend time with. And I will tell you this, without any joke, if I asked any one of my kids right now, you want to go to the dump with me? They'd be like, yep, I'll go. Now, why is that? Well, because the dump's always a good time. It's always a little bit of mystery.
Yeah, the dump is always
right? We're going to stop and get candy. So at the end of the day, the bottom line is that the worst you're going to come out with is a bunch of candy and a fun story. Okay, but that's part of fun parenting, making fun stuff out of nothing. You know, my kids will tell you a story about putting Christmas tree lights in the snow on a 30-foot high roof. Me getting my son, I used to call it special ops. She's got to shimmy out to the end, pound the nail in, hanging from 30-foot high, very vertical roof, right, without slipping, and then getting like the extended ladder, putting the lights up with me shaking the ladder, saying anybody can do it when the ladder's not shaking. Be a man. This is special operations, right? And them laughing their ass off, right? And then them trying to come down and me shaking it even more, and then they jump off the ladder. You know, I mean, all that's fun, stupid, making something out of nothing. But there's a deliberateness to this because by being a fun dad, by being somebody they want to be around, right, you gain more access to them. And hopefully...
Yeah, and it gives them a reason. It speaks to what I was saying about giving them a reason to respect you outside of fear. Right?
Absolutely.
Right? So that way, when you are mad, and you do say, you grab them by the shirt and you say, you need to listen to me, that has so much more weight when it's from the same guy that takes you to get candy when you go to the dump, and that messes with you when you're hanging Christmas lights, you know? If all you are grabs him by the shirt, it doesn't have a whole lot of effect
right.
anymore.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. But my point is that it shows that you care. Right.
You know?
My point is that consistency, again, this is my experience. If you're consistent from the time they're little, and when you say no, no means no, then it's easy. Parenting kids is easy, but
I gotta tell you, the lesson that I've gleaned from you here, you know, because I'm a beginner dad, you know, right. I'm still level one,
right?
But the real lesson I've gleaned from you in this, and I think that a lot of parents, Lord knows, I already have, probably easily lose sight of it, is that when you're trying to discipline the situation, you know, your kid did something wrong, you need to tell them not to do that anymore. It seems like for a lot of the time you're both managing the situation, but you're doing it with an eye to how this will unfold the person they become, which I think is an easy thing to not do when you're trying to get your kid to stop screaming at Walmart, right? It's easy for you to just go, I need to manage this situation in a vacuum. I need to get her to stop yelling. I need to get him to do what he needs to do. But it sounds to me like a lot of your effort was, I need to do this in a way that makes them a better person. I need to do this in a way that helps them develop into an adult. That's got to be tough to keep an eye on, but it sounds to me like, having met your son, it sounds to me like it's a method that works.
Well, I will just tell you this. You know, both my ex and I were both fun parents, right? But we didn't put up with a lot of bullshit. And when we said do this, we didn't. It wasn't chicken shit stuff. You know, when we wanted you to do something like pick up your towel or like pick up your toys, right? You didn't say no and walk away from us. That shit was not happening. When we told you to get away from the light socket, right? If you didn't, I mean, you got your hand whacked. You understood what no meant. Right, and when you didn't want to pick up your toys, you got taken over and you picked up those toys. And if you pay attention to that on a daily basis, it doesn't take that much time. But if you came in all the time, you're sending mixed messages. You're sending the message that you can win when you want to. You just have to yell loud enough. And if you send that message, then in years later, you try to change the messaging. You try to reel that back in. They already know what they know. I can break him down shotgun style. I just got to throw a big enough fit, and I'll get
my
way.
My daughter, I can speak lofty, but my daughter already knows this about me. I'm such a softy when, you know, Lord knows, if I had a son, I probably would have been better at discipline. But my daughter is only 9 months old. She'll wake up in her crib, and, you know, I'm up all night working, right? So she'll wake up at her crib at midnight, and I've got this little video monitor on my desk that I use to keep an eye on her. And I've got my rule. I'm like, if she just rolls over, if she starts goo-goo-ga-gaing, she needs to put herself back to bed, right? But, you know, if she starts standing up and trying to crawl out of the crib, we got to go get involved,
right,
you know?
Right.
But she now knows that if she can just stand up and try to crawl out of the crib, that'll come. So I've trained her now to try to kill herself anytime she wakes up. Because she knows that if she tries to kill herself long enough, Dad's going to come and save her.
But see, I don't think that's a big deal because it doesn't involve no. When you get to things that involve no, that to me is the red flag stuff. So that kind of stuff,
right,
I mean, and again, I was horrible at it because, I mean, my wife wanted to have our kids on a schedule, but I was in the field and I'd come home and like, you know what, if I get home at 8, you know, I don't get to see my kids for the third straight day because you want to have a schedule? Screw that, man. You're at home. You could take a nap, right? I'd wake them up. And you know what? And God bless her. She was very, very cool about it. You know, she understood. Like, I just want to see my sons, right? And then my our girls. And so, but when it came to yes and no, when it came to do what you're told, there was no quarter given in that. And my wife is...
And I think that's what it's got to be.
My wife is awesome. But again, and I will say this very selfishly, if you have well-behaved kids, guess who enjoys them more? You do. Guess who take guess what family goes more places as a whole family? Your family does. Guess whose life is better because their kids are disciplined? Your life is better. So ultimately, to get them to be well behaved is a matter of consistency and effort when they're little. And if you do that, the rest of your life you enjoy these little people and they become awesome young people. But it's a lot of work when they're little to get them to when you say no or when you say stop, they stop. Freeze, candidate. And you don't have to beat the shit out of them. But when they're little, they respond to your voice. They respond to the look on your face. And you give them little spiritual experiences so they know that I don't want to go there with that dude. I'm not sure why, but I don't go there.
I don't think there's a Marine who's ever achieved the rank higher than Lance Corporal that doesn't know how to turn on the voice.
Right. The voice. You know? Turn on the voice. But when you send mixed messages, kids pick them up. And when they know that they can break you down shotgun style, it's over. It's over. I look at the way people parent, and I look at that shit. I'm like, how do they do that every day? I couldn't do that. I'd walk in the house, what's up? You know, and you all these little bozo heads stick up from around like, what are you doing? Hey, zip your pants up. Well, hey, you wipe your face off. Why are you walking around like that? And you don't have to do stupid stuff because they know. Up is up and down is down. So, parenting advice. Yeah, my father-in-law, though, his thing, if they don't understand the word no and stop before they're two, you're going to have a hard, difficult, long existence.
So it sounds to me like I've got my work cut out for me.
What about
you
know,
no? 9 months, she's old enough now that she's starting to appreciate the way we respond. She'll watch us to gauge our responses to things. Which tells me that she's at the state where she's starting to cognitively understand that her actions have repercussions.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think it really, though, goes into motion is when they become ambulatory. When they begin, when they can walk and they start getting into things, and that's when you have to say, no, don't touch that. And then they look at you and they touch it.
And they touch it anyway. Yeah.
And then touch it. And that's when you walk over and you say, I said no. And then you flick the diaper. And you have to try not to laugh, right? And then you're like, I said no. And then you sit next to me here. And they have to sit right next to you. No. And they get done crying. Now give me a kiss.
We're going to watch an hour of Antique Roadshow.
Exactly. We're going to watch an hour of Bugs Bunny.
The lamest thing about me, I'm addicted to the Antistructure now. That's utterly unrelated. But my daughter can't stand it.
Well, look, it's nice talking current events with you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I promise to any listeners who haven't heard me come on the show before, you know, I also do a lot of work about foreign policy and defense. Mostly, you know, it's the Mike and Nellis parenting hour, but, you know, every so often, you know, we throw in a little bit of that.
All right, man. First of all, Alex, tell everybody where they find your serious work. Well, parenting's serious, where do they find your work?
Yeah, you can find my work now. It used to be softrep.com. You can still type that in and get there, but it is now thenewsrep.com. You can also find everything I do, to include this show, on alexhollings.com. I have links to all of that stuff. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter, and you can find me on Twitter at AlexHollings52.
Hey, I want to maybe have the guy who runs SoftRep, NewsRep on, because the whole news thing I find interesting, and I find your migration, I'm sure a lot of people are distressed about it. I'm not. I think that people reporting news responsibly is pretty important to the democracy. And we have a crisis in the country because you have people that don't do reporting. They use news as clickbait, again.
Or as a platform to push an agenda, see a lot of as well. That's what I like about working for this company is the emphasis on not doing that, so much so that, to be perfectly frank, I don't think anyone on the editorial staff knew my political leanings. Until, you know, a year after I started working here.
That's good.
You know, because there was no agenda that they were trying to give us. and we don't give you an agenda because, you know, we have a, it's a small group of writers, you know, we've got a pretty good network of freelancers, but as far as full-time staffers, there's really six or seven of us that produce most of the content you see on the site. And we're all, and you know, it's just like sparring. If your buddy's doing something that's not quite right, or you think could be better, it's your responsibility to tell him, not your responsibility to ignore it for the sake of his feelings. And we approach writing that very same way. You know, I have a very active relationship with my editors. I'm sure all the other writers do too. That's the reason why I think SovRep was successful and why I think NewsRep will be successful, is because we're trying to give you something that right now is kind of tough to find. And that is, this is the truth, the reality. Occasionally we're going to try to give you, you know, a little bit of our opinion, but we'll make sure that it's clear that it's there, you know?
All right, man. You have a good day, and I'm glad you got to come on, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
You got it, brother.
All right, man. There you have it. The one and only Alex Hollings here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. The Gunner hopefully joins us. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.